Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I'd buy you.
Hello, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 15. NASDAQ Futures up 190. It's all we do is go up. We have a, we're either having a massive reset of value here or a blow off top or something. Question is what we're doing, but we're seeing some numbers now that, what was the Three Dog Night song? I've seen things I've never seen before. In NVIDIA yesterday, up guy talking about God knows what. Stock is up $1.3 billion in market cap, which is probably more than the most expensive stock 20 years ago. The money supply number finally came out, even though the Fed had some sort of a glitch on the day it's supposed to come out. It didn't come out till later. Well, I'm sure some people had it. The right people always get this stuff. And it shows they were percolating along at this 4.9% money supply growth in the face of not a whole lot of growth in the economy anywhere, other than in stock prices. And I'm sure this month is going to be another $50-60 billion more in margin debt. It's kind of heading at a spot where you don't even know what the conclusion is. Clearly, you want to be long until you don't want to be, which is always pretty tricky. And this morning, you got Micron up another $6, and this stuff is just off to the moon. Nvidia up another $7.50 today. It's up trading 208.57. I thought it'd be 200 by the end of the year. It's 208. It's only October, so I guess I was a little short on that. We have Professor Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you?
Well, I'm coping.
What, are you long NVIDIA?
Take out the word NVIDIA.
Oh, all right, you're just long. All right, well, that's good. Better than nothing. At least you got something going for you,
Long. That's the long and the short of it. Yep.
Are you teaching?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I have a class this afternoon.
In town, or you got? You're how far is the place you actually go to teach, how far is that away from you?
About a 25-minute drive.
Oh, that's not horrible. Is it the other side of South Bend, or where is it?
Today's would be in Elkhart. I'm actually doing it via Zoom because of a little health issue today. But normally I'd be over in Elkhart today.
So that's where your main campus is, in Elkhart?
No, our larger campus between the South Bend and Elkhart locations is in South Bend.
I've been there in a while. Where in South Bend?
In the first half of the fall term, I was in. I was teaching in South Bend, a couple days a week. This half of the fall term would be Elkhart, and it just depends on where the class is located, and where the students are located. We offer classes on both campuses.
Where's the South Bend campus located?
It's just south of the downtown area. Not far from where the minor league ballpark is, where the Union Station Tech Center is, where the analytics data center is. So there's a little tech corridor down there. We're there. Jail's also there too.
Well, you gotta be jail.
Yeah,
it's a short trip for you when you mess up.
There you go. So we're on the south end, and then the Elkhart one is actually the bailing address is Goshen, because we're on the south side of US 20, but it's Elkhart County.
I don't think I ever really want to come from Goshen. The name just didn't ring right for me. I'm sure it's a nice place, but it's kind of an odd.
Home of Rick Meyer, former Notre Dame and pro quarterback Rick Meyer was from Goshen.
Remember the guys? God, this is...
Actually, it's a nice little city. It really is.
I'm sure it is. A lot of places in Indiana are real nice. They had a... They had a... Talk about commercials. This was so bad that I remember it when we were in college. And, of course, we had the TV in our lounge, but the black and white 19-inch. Who was the guy who did the commercials where the guy would come out and he'd talk about, here's a 71 Cutlass, you know, and or sell it for $4,500. And the other guy's like, you can't sell us for $4,500. God, you're an idiot. What are you doing? The guy, just for that $4,400. Remember the owners arguing with the salesman, and they'd keep lower. Finally, with the other commercial, it'd be like $4,100 to be all pissed off at each other. Like, who dreamed this stuff up? But anyway.
It's sort of like, the Bob Roman commercials.
Yeah.
And many others. Local auto dealers have the best commercials ever.
they do have some imagination, I'll say that for me. They also have the best sport coats.
They're cheesy, but they're all in on the joke.
Oh, yeah. Plus, they have the world's best sport coats. At least they used to. A lot of stuff going on in the world. You're glad you're not in Jamaica, huh? What do they get, like 25, 30 inches of rain? That's kind of a lot in a mountainous area.
I would say I'm very glad I'm not in Jamaica.
No, I think I'm going to cut right through Cuba and head up to Bermuda. At least they're all out in the ocean, except for if you're in Jamaica. God, can you imagine those economies? I mean, something like that happens. It's got to be horrible to start with. I was reading about how many people refuse to leave. They're just boarding the place up. They had all these shelters, and as of like 2 days ago, there were only like 300 people in the shelter. Nobody wants to go in the shelter. It's kind of odd, Kevin.
Is it dangerous?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know anything about Jamaica other than it was in one of the Bond movies. Was that Dr. No? Wasn't that in Jamaica?
Yeah, I don't remember which one. I know. I can envision the scenes you're talking about,
yeah.
But I don't know which one.
Boy, I'm talking about a long time ago. We have, what do you think of the sports world? What do you think of the Kelly deal? My thought was, since you regaled us very intelligently about the person in, the guy at Penn State, was named Franklin? And how he had, unlike the Charlie Weiss, we just give you all the dough, there was some caveats to it. So thinking that applied probably to the deal at LSU as well, I said, Kevin's
That's
probably
not
right.
Not that I have seen.
Well, man, I said if any of the stuff Kevin was talking about is down there as well, I bet Kelly settles for half and can do whatever he wants. And sure enough, he settled for half.
Let's catch the listeners up on what we're talking about there. Franklin had some clauses about having to, if they release him, he has to diligently pursue other employment, and that'll offset what he gets from them. They had some provisions about, you can't just go work for somebody else for a dollar. You had to get negotiate a competitive salary, so that you're only netting, you can't get that situation where you say, I'm working for them for a dollar, so you still owe me everything but a buck out of my salary. So there were some provisions in there. And that would include media, by the way. So he could, he can go to work in media, I suppose. And the offset won't be as big as if he were coaching, but it could be still substantial.
So it's not the Charlie Weiss deal. We owe you $4 million for 10 years. That's $40 million. You're just going to get it.
Yeah, you're just going to get it.
Well, it makes some sort of sense, but it's...
And I think Weiss was still getting paid even when he was the head coach at Kansas.
And when he left Kansas, he was getting paid by both. Because he got booted out of Kansas.
So, yeah, I think athletic directors over in general are just really crappy negotiators for contracts.
Well, they're so convinced that the alumni will step up and pay it that they don't care.
Well, I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure the other part of it is that they think they have their guy to be the head coach, and it's a competitive market once somebody's available, so they don't want to create a lot of provisions that are going to get in, that somebody else might not require, and so that puts them in an uncompetitive position. I sort of understand that, but, somewhere you got to draw a line.
When they say competitive, though, it's competitive within such a small group. And when one name comes up there, it's almost like a free agency. By any stretch, it's not competitive, Kevin, because there could be somebody who is just as good coaching in junior college in Montana that they're never going to even find because he doesn't have a name. You got to get the name, right? Otherwise, your alumni is not happy.
Well, and there's, you know, there's the hot coach, the flavor of the day, a flavor of the month type of situation where, you know, the guy has some early success, but at whatever school he's sitting at now, and then they find out that and he hasn't really proved it, you know, unless you've been someplace for a little while, you haven't proved anything. You know you may have, especially historically, you know, nowadays they turn over the rosters real quickly, and you know they do some things that might get them success. But we even saw that with Deion Sanders. He turned over the roster. He had some winning years at Colorado, but they've tapered off because he's not that great a coach.
And, you know what they say, Kevin? You should never have sex until you hit it before.
Sort of. But, yeah. You know, it's one thing to hire somebody with, 11, 12 years of head coaching experience. But let's go back to Brian Kelly getting hired by Notre Dame. What did he have? He coached at Grand Valley State at a lower level for a while and had some success there. But then he went to Central Michigan. They got some quick, early turnaround-style success, and he immediately bolted for Cincinnati. And the same thing at Cincinnati. They had some very quick turnaround success, and Notre Dame hired him. But if he had to be at Central Michigan for 5 or 6 years, if he had been at Cincinnati for 5 or 6 years, you would have an understanding of whether this guy can build a football program or not, and sustain it. But there was no such understanding. And why the athletic director at Notre Dame at the time, Jack Swarbrick, stuck by this guy when he did falter. If you remember, he had a 4-win season at Notre Dame. They had the incident with the student who was killed being up in the tower on an extraordinarily windy day.
That's when he lost me.
And they gave Kelly every damn thing he wanted. They gave him artificial turf in the stadium. They gave him his video boards. They gave you name it. They gave him everything he wanted. And then he had a contract extension. And a year later, after talking to LSU, he's back and saying, "Well, do you want to match them?" And they finally, at that point, said, "No," and had some frustration. But you know, this guy, and the fact is, he just was not a good guy. And there's a lot of things along the way.
My buddy at the Buckingham, who runs the manager of the club, he's a young African-American guy, real nice guy. He went to LSU. He's the happiest man on earth. He couldn't stand the guy. He goes, "I'll pay his airfare." get him the hell out of there.
Well, it's there for many to see, but the stories from the former, the football alumni, going back to people who real older people who were still around that played for ERA, they always felt unwelcome around the program, unwelcome to come back and be involved. And
who's worse on the idiot pecking order, him or Charlie Weiss?
Ooh, that's a tough call.
Charlie Weiss would allegedly use somebody's private jet and he'd bitch about the booze that was on there.
I don't remember Weiss being much of a drinker, though.
I mean, wherever the food or anything.
He was an eater.
Well, you know, as we kind of walk down this new road around, Kevin, and I think, you know, I won't say of all the sports reporters in the world, but you and I look at this more than just, you know, God, we're gonna do this and that, and we're going to win, and we're going to kick ass, and let's get the right guy. We don't care how much it costs. You know, I think both of us look at this as more of a business, more of a where are you going, how are you shaping the thing up. And we really don't, I don't listen to every one of these shows, but you don't see that much of this kind of an analysis. And I think it struck me the other day, I was talking a little bit about it with Mr. Flanagan, is you look at what these guys are doing, and every year now you start to zero in on the top, I'll say 30, 35 teams. Sort of like the top 30, 35 NFL teams, right? They're sort of the same. They're the four big conferences, throwing a Notre Dame, throwing them, you know, maybe a Pittsburgh once in a while, or there's, well, they're in a conference. But, I mean, there's not, the same people are deciding where they're going to be in this mess. You know, how much money they're going to put into this, how much they're going to pay people, how good their teams are going to be. And then you have this 12-game season, and everybody, but if you look at the top 15 teams now, you know, I guess LSU's out of the 15, but they're in, say, the top 20.
But in terms of attraction as a program, LSU would be pretty high because you have resources you would ever want to win.
But I'm saying, so say the top 25, and you look at these people, and the more you start playing each other, instead of, and maybe you're still going to play when these teams are absolutely the cat's ass top of the line because they've got all the paid players and other people don't. Maybe you can maintain this model where everybody's 10-2 because you got 10 chumps on there that aren't involved in the same level. Teams like they're not chumps, but teams like Purdue, teams like Northwestern, Indiana used to be, but now they've upgraded. I guess you can get there. Like the Irish are playing Boston College this week. The difference in payroll has got to be dramatic. You know, unless you keep that sort of thing going.
It better be, because Boston College is terrible if they're matching the payroll.
Well, that's exactly my point. But I'm saying, but you look at the pro teams, and you look at after week 8 or 9, everybody, well, there's a couple teams that are 5-1 maybe, or 6-1. Everybody's got 2 or 3 losses. As you go toward this, I'll use the term parity maybe sometimes is synonymous with mediocrity, but parity, the idea of the alumni getting some guy, Solomon or Caesar, whoever the hell he's going to be, that's going to be 12-1 every year, when all the teams that are paying everybody all this dough start to play each other more often, it ain't going to happen. That whole sort of thing, the idea that you hire a guy, you know, just happens to be Kelly, and we're not a big fan of Kelly's, hire a guy $8 million a year for 10 years. The first time he loses 3 in a row, you're gonna toss him? And then get another guy for $8 million for 10 years? If you start playing a schedule where all these teams are playing each other, everybody's going to have 3-4 losses. Is the college alumni mindset going to be able to change? Or do you can continue to have a team that's got a $40 million payroll playing Sidewash State 4 times a year? I mean, what is the model going forward? I'm asking a question. What is the model going to be?
It's a very strange model now because, as you stack it up against the NFL, size of the league, you know, the size of the quote league, if we were going to call Division One a league, is what, 30 teams, give or take?
You can say it's going to be similar, yeah.
As opposed to the NFL, which is what, 32?
Probably say 32 in college. You could add a couple in there.
So you can start looking at that difference. And then if the NFL were that big, you'd have plenty of chumps for teams to beat up on too. And then the rest, you know, they have a draft. They have very specific rules about how talent gets allocated around the league. And some people are smarter than others, and that's part of the game in the NFL. But in college, you got larger rosters, and the big mission for a coach more than anything else is to just recruit so damn many good players that, you know, if some of them fall by the wayside and some of them leave you, you still have plenty of the others. So that's part of what they're paying the big money for coaches to do, is to run the program, and running the program is a very different exercise in college football than it is in pro football. So that's why the money is, and that's why the impatience is there with it. I understand all of that. It's just a really kind of oddball business model if you think about it. Who would ever go set it up that way in the first place?
Well, plus it's in total transition. I would say that, by the way, NVIDIA's up another $8 this morning. That's $200 billion more, Kevin, in market cap. Does anybody have any idea how much money we're talking here? But, you know, Brian Kelly, I'm going to say he and all the people we see, Franklin, Jimbo Fisher, I don't think any of those guys has any friggin' idea, and neither do I, by the way, how to manage this transition period. Your people are calling you up. I guess they're in the portal, but there's got to be communication all over the place. I'm second string at God knows where. By the way, the two guys ahead of me are all American. I'm a stud. All right, well, I want $1 million a year and I'll come play for Notre Dame. Do you have any films? Well, no, I haven't been in a game. Do you have any practice films? No, they won't give them to me. Maybe you knew the kid from high school. And then he gets there and you're paying him $1 million. Say yes. And he's starting ahead of some freshman who says, hey, I'm better than that guy. Not only am I not making hardly any dough, but why aren't I playing? I can't imagine this recruiting process. I can't imagine how many people are trying to find films on all these guys coming back and forth. I can't imagine the politics in the locker room. I don't think Kelly, Jim, I don't know if anybody's, those guys weren't trained on that.
Your ability to be a leader in that kind of environment is really challenged. And when you get somebody like a Brian Kelly, who as a leader, in my opinion, is terrible, then contrast him with Marcus Freeman, who is really, really good at it. He's really good. It doesn't mean he never loses people and that people don't leave his program, but people don't leave his program saying he's a jerk. There are ways to deal with people in a high turnover business, so that some of them are more inclined to stay. Some of them might be more inclined to stay with you long enough to get a degree at your school before they move on, and that gets you a little, you know, that lowers your turnover rate. Because when you think about it, and this is true of any turnover, and remind me to come back to the term film, because I don't want to let that go. It's one of my favorite pet peeves. But if you look at any business, the turnover model is pretty simple. You're not competent the day you arrive, your first day on the job. Your productivity is near zero. And maybe in the case of a great halfback who all you have to do is give him the ball and say, run behind those guys, maybe it's not near zero, but it's not what it's going to be. And the longer you're there, the longer you're in the program, your productivity, your competence, whatever you want to call it, improves. That, you know, if you were to draw the curve for that, over time, it would just keep going up, 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 until you hit whatever your maximum is. And when you have a lot of people coming and going all the time, everybody who comes in is at that low end of the curve, and everybody who leaves has advanced somewhere up the curve. And whether you're running a manufacturing business, an accounting firm, or a football team, it doesn't matter. The more turnover you have, the more people you have at the lower end of the curve. And that's really, really, if you start thinking about, now how do I lead people? What do I have to do to either make the best out of that situation or to minimize the number of people who are going to bail on me sooner than they should? That starts asking a whole lot of questions about how you run your business, how you lead people in your business, and how you make the decision a little bit more challenging.
See, I think that everything you said there is perfectly correct, except I think what did William Kennedy say? The events are in the saddle and they drove the men hard. I think when you have 15 guys that talk their way on your team through the portal, talk their way, whatever, they get their way on there, and you owe them some money, and 10 of them don't pan out, you're going to find people getting cut before the school year. It's the only, I know I say this way too often, you can't be half a gangster. You can't be half a pro program. I mean, I happen to really like Notre Dame's coach. I think he's going to keep this thing sane a little longer than the other people, but I think in the end, they're going to get buried just like everybody else in whatever this becomes. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but
I think that the difference between him and many of his predecessors, so it's not just Kelly, but it definitely is Kelly, but you can go back, even Weiss, who was an alumnus.
He was a
problem. Tyrone Willingham had a problem. They don't get the school. And one of the things, and I this is probably true of every school, this is just the one I know. Notre Dame is a very quirky place. It has a lot of great things to offer, and some really great experiences and a wonderful alumni network and all of that kind of stuff. But it's not necessarily for everybody, number one. And number two is people like Brian Kelly just push back against that culture. It just, he considered it an obstacle, whereas Freeman really gets it. I don't know how he latched onto it, because he's not a graduate, but he really gets it, and he has since the day he arrived. And so he, you know, in his view, he'll wrap his arms around what it has to offer, and he'll help sell that. And that's why I said, if you get people to stay around long enough, for example, you get them to stay long enough to get a degree, it's because he works really hard to sell that aspect of the of his recruiting process, and that minimizes the number of people who bail on him. It doesn't mean nobody, because players want to play football, but it becomes part of your strategy for how you operate the program.
I don't have any issue with any of that, but when our guys are probably talking too much about Notre Dame, but it actually has a resonance just about anywhere. Our guys are our friends, and you a little bit, are absolutely convinced that somehow forever we can retain our moral backbone in a quagmire of no morals. And I don't if the place goes where I think it's going, I mean this football stuff, and you just become a sponsored professional.
You become one of the gangsters.
And I think that if one of these days Notre Dame sells out half their program to a private equity firm, I mean they're going to go with Freeman as long as they want, because people like him and he's a good guy and he's doing a good job. But the minute he loses three in a row, they don't give a shit. And it's unfortunate that that's where we're all heading, Kevin. But I don't think you can keep your head above water, above the cesspool. We're trying to do it. I don't know that we're going to get there. I mean, I think Indiana's actually trying to do it too. But I don't know that I over a period of time, I don't see how you stay above it. I mean, name me a benevolent NFL owner, for God's sake. If people oversell themselves during the portal, I mean, you and I know. I mean, you from teaching and me from business, whatever there's a reaction, there's going to be an equal and opposite reaction. If you got 25 people that show up, instead of having to pay them, you're going to be able to. You're going to have a tryout for these guys in July, and if they don't make it, you're going to cut them right there. You're not going to guarantee your tuition for a guy who says he's going to start for you, and all of a sudden he's no good.
I mean, it may eventually resent, because that's how the NFL works.
Yeah.
I fully acknowledge that it may move in that direction. I don't know how. I don't know how it's going to unfold. But that's part of it. But in the meantime, you know, what do you have to offer for these people over and above financial compensation? And then as coaches, they're, you know, the patience depends on the coach's past performance. I'll give you an example, and that would be, and he's far from my favorite person, is Dabo Sweeney. At a lot of places, his last two or three years would have him just as gone as Brian Kelly, but he did win, at least one national championship, maybe two.
He's another guy that's totally overwhelmed by the new system.
Oh yeah, he's not adapting to it well, and he was specifically pushed back against it. Said, "No, I'm not gonna take in as many transfers. I'm not interested in any of that stuff." Well, you know, that's not facing reality, what I'm getting at with him, in his case, is he did have enough. He has built up enough equity where, you know, people may grumble, people may not like what they're seeing, but at least he has the equity built up where they're going to say, "Look at the guy's record. We're not giving up on him yet."
But if you find him unable to, it's like the guy who's the world's best buggy whip manufacturer. If you move them into the auto industry, how long can you keep them there? Let's shift gears for a hair, Kevin. It's the same subject, but basketball has not necessarily gone all in on this. Sometimes I think in some of the schools they don't want any problems in the basketball program to affect their football team or whatever. But my buddy Bill Murphy is a big time Marquette fan. Talk about it. I tell you, Bill went on Marquette on a football ride, and then his freshman year they canned the team, and he's like, "What the hell?" And they end up boxing for him for 3 years or 2 years or something when they used to have intercollegiate boxing, and he kept his ride. But very disappointed when they cut the team. But the basketball team, he watches them religiously. What's the name of their guy? He's got that wacky name, the coach.
Shaka Smart.
What?
Shaka Smart.
Yeah, and he's a really good coach, I think. And he and the alumni are just not all in on this, to the point where they said, well, they weren't going to do any of this portal stuff. And now, you know, they're trying to get some money from some of the alumni.
That's not true, though. They've had a lot of portal activity.
I know, but I'm saying they weren't going to be in the paper competing for people in the portal, I guess is a better term. But now, of course, they're trying to get a little money from some of the people. But Bill says the first time he can remember, they're not in a preseason top 25. And they just can't get the guys. You know, and they're not sure that they want to go down that road. And I think some of the teams, you know, the Big East just happens to be pretty much all Catholic. They may decide not to, Kevin. I mean, they don't have football. Nobody knows their football, right? Or somebody at football. Who's the one team at football?
Connecticut plays football.
And but they're not. They're the only non-Catholic school, right?
No, Butler's not Catholic school either.
They're in the Big East? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought they were in the. Weren't they in the? They were in the what? The Mid-America or something?
They started out in the Midwest Collegiate Conference, and I think they moved up to the Atlantic 10, but then they got into the Big East. They've been in the Big East since it recreated itself.
Well, the one guy who went to coach the Celtics, not a general manager, when he was there, they weren't in the Big East.
Brad Stevens. No, they were not in the Big East at the time.
All right, but anyways, those guys, I don't think is a conference. They may say we're not doing it to that extent. Maybe. I don't think Marquette wants to be paying guys $2 million a year to play basketball.
But I think they also like competing at a very high level.
Well, I know. I'm saying, but I guess the question on the table, we're not disagreeing back and forth. Who's going to decide we're not in and we're not? I mean, are the Patsies going to continue to play the other guys? I'm not so sure. You know, I'd want Slippery Rock playing an exhibition game against the Bears. Would you?
Oh no, I agree. They have to sort it out. They've moved a long way towards the professional sports model, and yet they're not all the way there, and that creates some real oddities in there. And like you said, if they do break it out to 60 teams, 48 teams, or something like that for football, and it starts to resemble more a more rational sports league. Then along with that will come, a different playoff structure. You know, win your division, get in as a wild card, however you want to do it, and people will get in with lots of losses. Right now, you know, you get your second loss, and your chances of getting into the playoffs are very, very difficult. I hope they're not overly difficult, because I'd like to see the Irish get in, but... You know, if they don't get in, it'll be because they lost their first two games.
Well, do you have any, I've always been somebody who, you know, when we were there, it's not that the athletes could always, the only advantage I knew was the athletes could go to pick their classes before anybody else, allegedly, for reasons of schedule, I mean, allegedly. But it also means if they wanted to get in Rocks for Jocks, they got in Rocks for Jocks, but that would be geology for those that don't know. There were a couple of classes that everybody knew, you know, the athletes were in. But I also, Dave Casper was in economics like me. Whenever I was in class, he was there. I mean, I don't think the guy always looked to me like he had his homework done. I don't know if he was an A student or looked, it was none of my business, but... To say that he was playing the game, he was more than playing the game, I think. He was actually going to school. These people that are, when you watch these games, Kevin, it seems like virtually everybody who makes a good play went somewhere, and now it's like their third school, and that's a dramatic overgeneralization. But does anybody keep track of what they're doing in school? Do they even go? I mean, do the graduate students even go? I mean, I know it's a tough general question, but... It used to be a few years ago they actually tried to track people. Did they even make that attempt anymore?
Yeah, they still have the academic progress requirements, so there is some kind of an attempt there, and that's a big challenge, not just for the football program or the basketball program, but it's a big challenge for the academic side of the house. to try and maintain some kind of continuity there.
What the? You don't mind? Let's. I know you're not a market guru, but.
Well, wait. Before you do that, let's go back. Let's go back to film.
Film.
Because the term film. Do you have any film? Do you have any tape? I hear this 100% of the time on sports media. Sports media people, football coaches, athletes, everybody. They say, "Well, I got to check the film. I got to check the tape."
For me, it's a generic term. Knowing that, how do you have any idea how good the guy is?
Yeah, I get it. The thing is, we haven't stored anything on film for over two decades in athletics.
Well, I mean,
nobody has film, nobody has tape. It's all digital. It's look at the video. But everybody, and I'm saying this is 100%. There is nobody who says, I'm going to have to look at the video before I really know what happened. Nobody. Everybody says they have to look at the tape or they have to look at the film. It is just a real strange oddity that we have in the language. That,
well, it's because that's what they, that's the term they've used for, you know, watching practice afterward, watching games afterward. The term has been film. Whether it's film or not, what difference does it make?
Well, it doesn't, other than it just is, it abuses me. What's really funny about it is you have a whole generation of athletes who have not known anything, who have never seen anything on tape or on film. They have only seen video, and they still call it the tape or the film.
Well, you remember the story about Bobby Douglas, where he left the Bear training camp, and because he was supposed to be studying the film back when they had film, and he had all the game films, or he had in his car, and of course on the way home he stops at Division Street to try and find a little action. When he comes out, the windows broke and the films were all gone. The Bears were not happy.
No, I imagine they weren't. So who did they have following him around? An opponent?
Well, he went and lived with the coach for a while, remember? Or the coach moved in with him, Jim Dooley. He's a big guy. So I saw him at a basketball game one night, and I'm looking in the bathroom. I look at the guy next to me. I go, oh, my God, it's Bobby Douglas, big dude. He was a hell of a player. I mean, I don't know if he should have been a quarterback.
He was a great athlete and just not a very good quarterback.
Plus, he was on one of those teams where could anybody have been a good quarterback? Yeah. It's hard. The Bears have had like a whole string of.
The mission is to not suck.
Yeah. What is the everyman? By the way, I walk up to the favorite watering hole last night, and the bartender, nice guy from he's from. Where's he from? Guatemala, someplace. He's here with his family. I don't ask if he's citizen or not. I don't want to tell. I think he probably is. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. He's been around long. Maybe he's not. But anyway. He says, "Hey, Chief, you're in the money management business, right?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I want to invest like $1,000 in Bitcoin." And I'm going, "Oh no, Jesus!" I said, "We don't really do that kind of stuff." I wasn't going to tell him to go to an ATM. I wouldn't be that big of an ass. I go, "Well, how did you settle on Bitcoin?" "Well, all my buddies are in, and all it does is go up." "Do you know anything about it?" "Yeah, it goes up." Okay, then. I mean, this is the conversation from hell, Kevin, and I said, "Well, you know, I'm not a huge fan of this Bitcoin stuff. I mean, I don't really know what it is. And by the way, what do you think it is?" "Well, I don't know. It just goes up." I'm thinking, it's not like the stuff I talk about on the air doesn't happen, Kevin. It happens. I mean, what do you think of these companies? Some of these guys are going up like, you know, $3 trillion, $4 trillion, $5 trillion. At the same time, when you're talking about, I wonder where this. I think we would have to agree. I don't know if we agree on the policies. I'm not so sure there is a policy. But on the one hand, you have this incredible amount of wealth being built. You got money pouring in the system. And every day it seems like you have less and less people, you know, whether you're for the extension of the SNAP program or not, or whether you're for some kind of housing program or not. It has to be painfully obvious to just about everybody that higher and higher percentages of your population cannot feed and house themselves on what they're making or not making if they're not working. I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't be working or anything, those things, but those percentages seem to be getting higher and higher. And every day you're hearing about layoffs at one level, or the other level, guys are getting massive contracts to, you know, these companies, and guys are making gazillion dollars. I mean, there's some disparity here, Kevin, and I don't know that it needs to come back together, that it's going to come back together. Is it going to be a violent shift, not a shift, or is it just going to, we're going to end up being you know, the nobles and the peasants, or I have no idea where it's ending, and I can't see, you know, there's no policy here that I can say, gee, if you just do it my way, somehow or another this would all work out. And you got a mayor here who wants to put a head tax on every company that's over 100 people, and everybody's over 100 people can't wait to get out of here now. The guy doesn't have any concept of what's going on in the world. I mean, I know that's the wrong idea, but I can't tell him what the right idea is to raise any capital either. So, I mean, or any cash. To me, it seems I don't even know. I'm totally at a loss for solutions here. Although some I see proposed on every level, state, federal, and city, seem to me to be not the right ones. But, I mean, I seem like I can pick those out, but I almost can't tell you what the right one is. So I'm lost here. Find me.
Well, let me see. How can I help you? Maybe we stop spending government money on... Not government money, because that's our money. But maybe we stop spending on stupid stuff.
The stupid stuff is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, first of all, we understand, because we talk about it all the time on this show, we understand the structure of the healthcare system and the damage it's done to the federal budget. But when you start thinking about, you know, all of these activities that we do, so I'll give you an example. Let's take, you know, all the money we're spending on climate change. How much money do you suppose over the last 15, 20 years we've spent trying to fight climate change issues?
Well, I mean, I'd like to see a list of what we spend. I mean, if some of it is on an alternative energy that actually works, maybe we could have done it better. But you know, I mean, that's to me, you know, it's not to say it's not the total waste as paying, you know, $40,000 for a chemo treatment that cost the guy $500. I mean, I don't know how you get that back. You know, the climate change. Let's hope. I mean, I'm with Carl on the fact that we probably shouldn't have put as many solar collectors out there, and we don't have any idea how we're going to recycle them. But the fact is, I think some of them are collecting. At least they're doing something. You know what I'm saying? I'm with you on that, and I don't like the idea of going to these all electric cars when nobody even has a thing to plug them in without the idea, and then we're tearing down power plants on top of it. You're not going to get any argument out of me as if ever this stuff is any is coordinated
no,
at all.
I'm just using this as a model.
Yeah.
You know, we can debate the issue of, you know, the value the situation or not. I don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
I want to think of it more as a model. We have spent, I don't know how many trillions, but lots of trillions on this. And yet, everybody who is...
I don't think we've spent it. I think we forced other people to spend it, which is just as bad, by the way.
However you want to do it.
Yeah.
We as a society have spent the money. And yet, it's still an emergency. We're still, you know, looking down the barrel of the gun. We haven't, you know, at least according to the zealots, we have not moved the needle a bit. And we need to spend more. Now, if I'm telling you, if we have spent that many trillion dollars and have gotten nowhere, and we just and the solution is spend more, that sounds kind of stupid to me.
That sounds like paying college football players. We just need to pay more.
however you want,
yeah.
You know, however you want to look at it, it just sounds like a really, really stupid approach. And you know, if somebody took that to the CFO of a company and said, here's what we have to do, they'd get laughed out of there and probably wouldn't continue to have a job. And so this is what I mean, is we spend a lot of time and a lot of money just doing things that don't work. And the only solution that we can keep coming up with is spend more money to keep doing the same things.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things you brought up there was, you talk, we, especially people that, you know, I guess are educated. And when I was in grad school, it was pretty interesting, Kevin. It was always the idea that somehow or another, these corporate people, these politicians, whatever you want to call it, the people in charge, this might have been a World War II model, I don't know, that if you just got high enough up the chain, you would get by the bozos and you would find, as the Jewish term is, the mensch, somebody who actually had some morals, somebody who could understand that if you were trying to do the right thing, eventually you would find somebody that would understand what you're trying to do, reward you for your efforts, and oh, by the way, might even go with your idea. And the mantra today on a lot of you know, some of the conservative people, some of the liberal people, is if we just would run things like a business. Businesses bleep up all the time. They just have to pay for it, right? I mean, some of them do.
And that's the difference, is you have to pay for it, you have to react, you have to course correct. And we don't do that.
Well, I mean, individual people.
We don't do that in government.
You drink too much booze, you got a hangover. Duh, right? I mean, in government manages, but some businesses are. I'll give you a quick example, Kevin. I want to talk to you about this, but we were talking about other stuff. We don't know who the somebody is. If you Google PTI Securities right now, you're going to get another site in addition to ours. And this is happening all over. It's nothing we did. It's nothing we didn't, you know, look at or anything like that. But all of a sudden now, they took all the pages of our website, put them on their own website, and they're trying to get money into a bank account in Canada. Well, now, of course, we called the bank and did all this other kind of stuff, so we're not going to accept it, allegedly, if anybody's stupid enough to send it. And the thing is at GoDaddy, which is pretty much a monopoly. There's a couple of them, and
they're not a monopoly. No, I would say that's not true.
Okay, but okay.
You can register your.
But, all right, let me finish the story, and now it comes up first in Google, which to me means somebody's paying Google to use our name ahead of ours. So we filed all the reports with Google and GoDaddy. They both came back, but an up yours, not our job. Google doesn't care; they're getting paid, because the host is in Europe. They totally pull their hands off it. And of course, I went to the FBI site to let them know, because it's trying to get money to send money to Bank of Nova Scotia. They're down. By the way, fill out this form. There's some outfit that takes care of cybercrime allegedly, because they notify all the police departments, or whatever you want to call. So I filled out this long, laborious form. That was a week ago. I haven't heard from anybody. So the idea that all these people actually give a crap, Kevin, and Google actually got back to us, not our problem. Okay, well, what do you mean? It's a wrong name, a fraudulent name is coming up on your website, and you're getting paid for it. It's not your problem, not our problem. And if anybody doesn't think this monopoly, no law applies to these people, thing isn't going to affect you at some point, I'll say this: you're an idiot, because it will. If you're doing, I mean, what we're seeing happening, Kevin. I mean, the concentration not only of wealth but of power. We are turning into an absolute plutocracy here, and nobody seems to. I don't know how you fight against it, or how you and I could fight against it. But I mean, the fact that to not recognize it's happening. I mean, what do they say in a? Used to say in the trading floor, there's three kinds of people in the world. Some people make things happen. Some people watch things happen. The rest of the people wonder what happened. I mean, I think most of us are in the wonder what happened category here. Or, you know, I mean, it's a little dour in the future, but this is nuts. Just saying.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. It's, you know, I know that's a bad way to wrap up our hour, but with agreement. But
you know, yeah, well, yeah, we're not supposed to agree.
It happens once in a while.
One thing we do agree on, we want you 100% healthy. Who else can I fight with?
Yeah, well, I've got nice little medical procedures scheduled for Monday, and we'll see what we learn from that.
All right, and besides, you know, it's very disarming when somebody younger than you doesn't feel well.
Yeah.
It's not the way it's supposed to be.
Unfortunately, almost everybody's younger than me.
Well, that's a problem, but when do you think I guess I shift subjects, but to me it's kind of all the same subject. You know, what are we doing? How are we going to? What's the future going to look like for everything? What do you think? We got a couple of minutes. By the way, the second hour today is going to be interesting. They both, Dr. Russell and Dr. Demiak, are at some big time conference today. By the way, we weren't invited, Kevin. Just saying.
I probably was invited.
God, I knew you were going to say that. You probably were invited. I was not invited. So we're going to have Bill Moriarty on, who's been on a few times. He's a civil engineer. You know, the reason why I want to talk to him, Kevin, and if you have any questions, feel free to pop in. Bill was a civil engineer. Somewhere along the way, he kind of veered away from highways into water treatment facilities, and he's pretty much an expert on that. And these things are long-term projects and so forth. And, you know, I talking to Carl and a little bit to you about, the president, and I agree with this 100%. Once, I don't think an executive order does anything, but once go back ahead with the nuclear stuff, I don't know why we stopped it. Obviously, Jimmy Carter was the person who didn't feel at the time that it was safe in civilian hands, and maybe at the time it wasn't, but I don't know if it should be a 40-year decree either. Matter of fact, it should not have been 40 years, but it seems also now if somebody says, okay, we're gonna build 5 reactors, I'm going to say, according to Carl, there's a pretty serious debate. What does he have, 2 or 3 different kinds of potential styles of reactors going forward? So, I mean, I wanted to ask Bill, by the way, if somebody wanted a water treatment plant in, say, South Bend, when somebody says that, do we all know the kind we're talking about, or is it going to take 2 or 3 years of competing designs before we even, in other words, how quickly can we do this? I mean, we're talking about...
Choose. First of all, what's actually in the field and proven? What's working someplace?
Yeah.
So that would factor into any rational decision making. I would start there and say, okay, does that make sense for me?
Having said that, off the top of our heads, top of our thinning heads, when was the last design plant? Well, the one just was put online in Georgia, right? The last one this year, early this year. There's no more under construction. I'm going to say, without knowing, I'm going to say that's probably close to the same design that we used 60 years ago. And Carl says now that there's a potential of what's a solid sodium reactors, but nobody's ever done it. That would take a, some sort of a small one put together to see if the concept worked. And what was the other? There was one other one he was talking about. Anyway, there's probably at least 3 competing designs right now. And you're absolutely correct. Okay, what do we have now? Well, we've got the one down in Dresden, south of Chicago. We've got, there's a few of them here. There's a couple in Michigan. There's a few around. Now, are you going to take that 60-year-old design and say we want one just like it? I'm going to say probably not, but I don't, maybe the answer is yes, but I'm going to say probably not. Are we going to totally change the thing into something we've never done yet? That's a problem if we want to do 10 of them in the first year, right? You're sure the hell not going to go down the road with 10 of them and find out none of them work. I mean, it's kind of what
that's all risk assessment. So, that there are people who can rationally make those kinds of decisions about which ones they are based on what the payoff's going to be versus what the risk of it not being adequate will be. There's always going to be some people who are going to, try and push the envelope and get to the latest and best technology, and your next guest can talk about that. But ultimately, if you're making decisions, especially, if it's private companies, they're going to do the risk assessment, or they should, and most of them do. But if it's government, they aren't very good at risk assessment. They just fall in love with things and do it.
Well, I think that where I'm trying to land here is maybe we can get an assessment out of Bill, or we can all just kind of kick it around. If we're talking, I mean, when this has nothing to do with Trump, because like I said, he did the right thing by saying, hey, we got to get back on this nuclear shtick, guys. I'm all for him on that. But the impression to most people is, okay, that's a solution. Now, if we do it properly and it's 12 years out, and I'm all for doing stuff properly, that means we probably got to stick with the coal-fired plants for a while. We're not going to have any power. I mean, if you make that decision, Kevin, and you put the 12-year number on it, or 15 or 10, like maybe legitimate ought to be, instead of 5, it really makes a difference in what you do in the meantime, right?
So I go back to what I said earlier. What are the zealots telling you to do? Nope, got to shut down the coal plants now. You have to transition. This is all rational stuff, and that's why I said we got to stop spending money on stupid stuff.
Well, but the rational stuff here when I don't know that it was necessarily zealots, well, to a certain extent maybe, but say, I mean, I don't think we wanted the coal plant sitting in the middle of the city anymore, but let's say, for instance, the one that was down on the east side, it was pretty much by the lakefront. That particular plant was 70 years old. Okay, and we had three of them here in the city that were all decommissioned and knocked down in the last 5 years, 8 years. Now, those were, they could all have stayed open, Kevin, but to bring them up to current standards, which is a lot, you know, not just pouring, you know, dark smoke out of the top, it was a, you know, at the time it was a $100 million deal, or $80 million or something, or 60, whatever the number was. And Commonwealth Edison elected to say, no, we're not going to do it. And they actually, what they did, this is sort of him slimy, they sold them to other people to run, and then they bought the power back from them. And then at the end of the day, they said, well, we're not going to help you update them, or something along those lines. So they essentially kicked them to somebody else, and somebody else got screwed on the deal, I think was what happened, but I don't know all the details. But now, if we have a government that actually had some sense, you might say, okay, guys, we all want these power plants down, but in the meantime, until we can get another couple of nuclear plants up, we got to extend the life 10 years. And by the way, we'll cough up, you know, 25% of the $100 million, and let's keep them going for a while. So at least they'll be clean, and we know at the end of 10 years, as this plant comes on, they're going some sort of rational thing like that. You're right. We don't see it, do we? Nobody seems to be able to talk to each other.
Yeah, we have a really hard time with that. And I would say, you know, if only you had an expert to comment further, coming on the show in about a second.
Yeah.
That would be a good thing.
So we'll talk Saturday. What's the latest on the last Southern Cal game, or what?
Don't know yet. They're still trying to work it out. But, yeah, Southern Cal doesn't want to play because they got too much of a Big Ten commitment and too much travel.
Well, if you're going to play...
If the series does end, at least I know that it ended on a three-game Notre Dame winning streak.
Well, to show once in a while that all the disparate stuff I have people talk about, it all comes back to the same... It's the same subject. The first, Kevin and I started talking about, if you are Southern Cal and you are that coach and you're expected to go 12-1 or whatever they have, 11-1 and make the playoffs, if you know you're going to play Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State in the same year, what manner of moron would want Notre Dame on the schedule? If you're going to be judged, if you're not 11-1, we're firing your ass.
Yeah.
I mean, really? I mean, why would you?
There's also been a longstanding notion that if you really want to force Notre Dame to join a conference, the easiest way to do it is to not schedule them.
Well, that's true. And I don't know. Yeah, if they ever... Well, it'll be interesting to see if that ever... I think the disparity between... I think the basketball team's going to end up back in the Big East someday, but what does that do to all the other teams?
That's it. The reason they're not in the Big East now, and I really, you know, we really should wrap up because you have Mr. Moriarty.
Well, he's with us, okay.
But I miss the Big East. I would much rather be playing Villanova and Providence and Georgetown and Marquette and, you know, all of those teams on a every year basis, home and homes. I would much rather that than the ACC for basketball. But the ACC for all other sports is the better choice. That's what drove the choice. It's women's basketball, whether it's soccer, you name it. You can pick a sport. Lacrosse. You know, it's. I mean, everything else being in the ACC, baseball. It's a better conference for all of those than the Big East ever was and ever, you know, probably ever will be. And the only other sport that they have that doesn't go to the ACC is hockey, and that's in the Big Ten for hockey.
What's the budget for sending a girls' volleyball team or a guys' volleyball team out to Stanford to play? They're in the ACC now, right?
Yeah. It's a pain, and at least, you know, I'm sure the athletic department can afford it, but still, that doesn't make it a profitable venture. But we've talked about why you do all that kind of stuff, too, and we can do that Friday if you want.
All right, well, let's shift over. Mr. Bill, you with us?
Hi, Tom. How are you? Can you hear me?
Good. How are you? We can, what's his name? Andrew will up your volume of hair, but yes, we can hear you. We gave you quite the preamble. I don't know if you were listening, but I guess my first question is, everybody remembers Bill. Bill does he's been on the show a few times, and by the way, we always get good notes afterward when he's on. I guess my first question to you, Bill, and I know you were involved in a couple of times. I even met you when we were on the road at our paths crossed, where you were putting in a water treatment facility. I guess my first question is, when you got involved, was there always just one design that people were zeroed in on, or did you ever get at the stage where, yeah, we need a treatment facility, but there's three different ways we can go, and everybody, were you ever involved in one like that, and how did that process take place? Because it looks like, as we go nuclear here again, there might be two or three different competing designs, a couple of which have actually never been tried, but makes sense.
The way we do things in the water treatment business would be, if we were starting from scratch, and let's say we'd have a water source, and that water source could be Lake Michigan, it could be groundwater, it could be a different lake. All these lakes have different chemistries. So the first thing you would do is look at others that are treating the water out of the water source. So generally speaking, and I don't know this because I haven't worked in Chicago in a long time, but a lot of your people on Lake Michigan probably do very similar treatment because it's tried and true, led by what the City of Chicago Water Department does. But probably the next step is to do what's known as a pilot study, where you would set up in mobile trailers treatment gear, and you would literally for a year or 2 years sit there and treat the water and experiment and try this and try that, try this particular chemical, try different things until you reach something that was working well. And once you got the process pinned down, and in many states, you know, you've got the state health department looking over your shoulder pretty carefully, because one thing the people in the water business try to avoid is like poisoning people.
That's a good idea.
That's like the worst thing you can ever do. You're out of business forever. And so a lot of people looking over your shoulder and looking at your design, pilot it through, and then you would design it. But let's just say you decide to locate a site for the water treatment facility. This is for drinking water. Well, you're going to buy some land near the water source. And of course, you're going to buy plenty of land because you know you're going to be expanding that plant over the years as the town or the city grows. So the engineer will do multiple layouts, and he'll say, well, even though we only need 10 million gallons a day now, let's project the population for 50 years, and how big would it be then? Okay, we would need 50 million gallons a day in 50 years. So we're going to buy enough land, and we're going to look at common infrastructure components that we can build now and not have to do over. That would be like the intake. So we may make some things big enough so that we don't have to go back on them. But generally, the plant itself, with its various vessels and treatment facilities, will be built for the initial need. And so you get started and you now have this plant, and it's going to be tested out very thoroughly before the water is introduced into the public system. But over the years, things happen that you don't know about, and that could be there's some new emerging dangerous chemical that's in the water, and all water treatment officials kind of share info. Hey, are you watching for this? Hey, what about that? And so occasionally it results nationally where people say, we got to do something different with our disinfection. because we've got problems with the disinfection in water. Always used to be chlorine, and that's evolved over the years. There's other things that come along that are kind of more like tweaks than they are massive changes. So you're always ready for that. And then when you get to the point where the plant is about 75% used, then it's time to start thinking of the next expansion. And generally, if the plant worked okay, didn't have any problems or whatever, phase two will be designed quite similarly. And then you just go on from there. But of course, nowadays, a new actor has entered the water treatment business called membranes. And these are kind of been brought on with the world of desalinization, but they can also be used if the water, raw water source, is kind of a problem. And sometimes water sources...
Okay, back up just a hair. So let's just say we're on Lake Michigan, and right. somebody's trying to do something somewhat similar. There's got to be some entrenched group that has built the last five or expanded the last five. These companies are 100 years old, half of them, right? I mean, or the engineering firms, and say, okay, here you go. Here's a new plant for Lake Michigan, and kind of like the other ones, but a little bit better because we've learned, like you say, the stuff along the way. All of a sudden, a guy named Bill Moriarty comes flying out of here, he's a PhD and something. He goes, wait a minute, guys. Here's something that we've been talking about it in schools and in theory, and it's a whole different way of doing this. Sort of like, you know, Carl's talking about the solid sort of liquid sodium atomic plant where you know you don't have as, they're not as dangerous and you can shut them off and blah blah blah. And you say we need to at least go down this road. Does it? You kick the guy out of the room? Do you wait a year for him to try and let you, or 2 years if you really need it? I mean, how does that get resolved?
Well, probably one of the bigger agencies, like let's say the city of Chicago, if there was some promising technology, they would pilot it at one of their water treatment facilities and say whatever the issue is.
Now, who pays for that?
The customers of that water system, unless the water utility is astute enough to get some kind of a grant from EPA, which are pretty thin these days, but in the old days, not impossible, you could get.
But if it was promising enough, the government might say, God, if this works, it's going to work for everybody, so we'll keep...
We can share the technology. And the people in the water industry are great sharers of information. They don't care if they paid all the money to figure out something. If you asked them, could we have all your paperwork and see how you did it, they would just plop it on a desk. They wouldn't say, well, that's private. It's kind of an interesting breed. It's like everybody helps each other. So if Chicago did something, they'd likely write a scholarly paper about it, and publish it.
It was like the movie Airplane, where everybody, all the mechanics, even though the bosses didn't know about it, all helped each other.
Yeah, and then you go to conferences, and those same people will make presentations. Here's how we did it. And then you could walk up to them and say, hey, could I make a visit to your plant? They would love to have you. You would fly in, and you could march around for a couple of days and learn everything you want about it. And so it's a pretty good group of people that when it comes to figuring out stuff, they all help each other.
All right, so somebody could do something like that, but it still would be a big step for somebody to say, the old guys, get the hell out of here, we're going to go the new route.
Yeah, I mean, if it's pretty dramatically new, and I could preach or speak to the city of Austin, where I've lived for 25 years now, and we have three water treatment plants, and 10 years ago we added a brand new one. But it was the same water source, these lakes on the Colorado River Lake Austin, Lake
Colorado, not being in Colorado, Texas, Colorado.
Right, it's a little different Colorado. And so when they located this plant, it was going to come out of the same water system. So they generally went with the exact same process the other two did. I believe they did some piloting work on it. They ended up with a process that's pretty well known called lime softening, which is pretty common around here. You get a nice soft water out of the treatment process.
And when you say soft water, what's Chicago water? Is that soft or hard?
It's probably pretty soft. I would think the customers have demanded it. You know, it's just, if you have a softer water, it kind of lathers up better than...
What's like the stuff like in whenever I went to South Bend, which I was for 4 years, or visit my family in Columbus, it's more than anybody needs to know, but if you, you're in the shower and you put a bunch of soap, say on your underarm, it won't rinse off. The water won't dissolve it. It's like it takes you forever to get it off. Now, what's that? Is that hard water?
It'd be hard water, yeah.
It doesn't dissolve the soap. It's the weirdest thing. Notre Dame was like that before.
It's the pH of the water. And so if you were here, I think Chicago has very good water. I always drank it my whole life, obviously. And I think the city of Austin has good water. So they have stuck with the lime softening, which is not a very complicated thing. Some people in the water community said, hey, we're building a new water plant. Why don't we step up to that next level of membranes? City didn't want to do it, said we don't have to do it. We're fine the way we go. And they've been, you know, they put this new plant online 10 years ago, and this worked just fine, so from everything I know. But I think in the future you will see, as more tricky chemicals get discovered or more tricky chemicals get introduced into these water bodies, you will see people say, when we do an expansion, we're going to take our old plant design and modify it into something higher level of treatment, which will be membrane technology.
So what can you filter out?
Can you
filter out like the old antifreeze? Can you fiddle out the bad metals?
You can filter everything.
Okay.
It filters out stuff so much that you have to put minerals back in because it's the tightest treatment in the world right now. And again, it kind of, if I'm correct on this, kind of originated in the desal business where people had to treat ocean water and get the salt out of it, which is the hardest water to treat. But then if you want to take a traditional surface water that's not considered salty, the membranes work really well with that. But again, we're seeing more and more attempts at desal facilities. I kind of read the literature, and around here, we are running out of water. And the state of Texas has recognized that and is putting a ton of money into water facilities to the tune of $1 billion a year for the next 20 years. We're going to have a proposition election on November 4th to vote to peel out of the state budget. The money, I believe, comes from sales tax. They have a surplus, so that's why kind of they're doing it. And they're going to throw $1 billion a year that cities can compete for. The part of the money goes to desal.
Well, when you blow through one of these membranes and you get all the salt out, what do you got left? Like distilled water? Is it good for anything? Is there any oxygen in it? What do you got to do?
Well, they can put anything back into it that they need to do, but the byproduct that's the headache is the brine, which is the salty part, and that's where they get into trouble because typically the water utility just wants to throw it back in the ocean or throw it back somewhere, and nobody wants that stuff. So they get into big environmental.
Is it like water that you get at the Dead Sea or something?
It's like obviously a super salty, thick goop, and if you throw it in these bays like Galveston Bay, where they have a lot of fishery stuff going on, it will kind of screw them up. So they get into big court fights about the disposal of the brine. That's usually the big issue.
How far out do you need to go? Like miles?
Miles. Got to go way out, and the boys don't want to build those long pipes. But that's what they usually end up doing, is figuring out a long pipe, deep erosion, away from the bay, and then everybody says it's okay.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it is. And they've done this enough that, you know, they can...
So if you were in New York City, you'd be 5 miles offshore?
Something like that. Yeah, I think so.
That's a hell of a pipe, yeah.
They kind of study the currents and stuff to make sure it doesn't just, you know, come back on you. And, you know, I think they've got ways to figure that out these days.
So that's so if you had, like, a crummier water source that you couldn't... Or if it had some kind of pollution in it or something, you can use these membranes to get you back to square one, but then you got to add stuff back to it, right? Well, didn't you say that a lot of times you always had to add oxygen back in, right?
Not necessarily. I don't think there's any oxygenation step in any of the plants in Chicago, but it's possible.
They do on the canals. That's one of the reasons why they have they've got some fish back in these canals. If you go by, matter of fact, I don't know if you've been around. There's a golf course right on 100. Remember 115th, where we used to turn to play golf down at Westgate, which is long gone. 115th in Harlem there.
Right.
There's now a golf course there. And on the other side of the street, they've got a whole system of all these fountains. And they look really nice. They drag the water out of the Kelsag Channel, which is pretty much dead water, right? And they have all these fountains as a way to oxygenate the thing. And there's probably 8 of them along, or 5 or 6 of them along the canal. And evidently it adds oxygen back in by spraying it up in the air and having it land again or something simple like that.
Yeah, that's a very common technique. And what might be happening there is wherever those fountains are, they're probably a lagoon and they want to keep a fish population going.
No, they just go right back in the canal. But the weird part is, it's so picturesque that on every Saturday there's probably 10 weddings there. They use that as the backdrop, the dirty water pilot out of there being oxygen. But it looks great. they actually have weddings there every week.
Great, have a dirty water wedding.
I mean, it's not splashing on you. I don't think you want to land on your bride's outfit, but it's very picturesque. It looks like you're at Buckingham Fountain, but it's a dirty water oxygenator. So I mean, it works for a lot of stuff. What can I tell you? Plus, there's a nice golf course there. So wasn't there when you were?
I did a job some years ago up at DFW Airport. And I'm sure you've flown in there many times. Oh, yeah. You see these little lakes in the middle of the airport. And one thing the airport there did, which was not, they were naughty boys, was they let some of their anti-icing chemicals get in the lake. And if you've ever been around de-icing chemicals, they are the most oxygen demanding stuff on the planet. So if you have a lake with fish, and you introduce de-icing chemical, you're going to have floating fish. They're all dead because it pulls all the oxygen out of the water, and the fish need oxygen to survive.
Is that the same thing like antifreeze did?
Yeah, this is very similar stuff. So I got involved in that, and they had a huge fine, and they had the state environmental people down their throat and everything. And so what we did, kind of similar to your wedding venue, we installed a pipe, and this is all kind of an emergency deal, kind of ringed the lake, and we put these big honking sprinklers on. And basically there was a pump station that was already there for some purpose, kind of tapped into that, and basically we ran the sprinkler, the big sprinklers, you know, tick, 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 tick kind of sprinkler, and just shot the water back onto the lake. And in that process of picking up the water, throwing it in the air, and throwing it back onto the lake, it rose the oxygen level, and everybody was happy.
So it wasn't the stuff was poisoned, it dragged oxygen out, and that's what killed the fish.
That's right. Yeah, the
That's interesting.
They refer to that as dissolved oxygen, oxygen to water. Fish need that to live. And you drive that down low enough, they're just all going to die. And what happened in that case was killed every fish in the lake. And, of course, there's some busy roads that go through this airport and stuff. And people were looking out their car windows seeing the floating dead. And everybody had the, you know, calling 911 and calling this and calling that and getting it on TV. And where you know it, everybody was going nuts. God.
You must come across some amazingly interesting stuff in your biz. I mean, I do in mine a little bit, but most of it's bad. How many plants are ongoingly being built now in this country? But there's no nuclear reactors being built, I don't think.
Oh, in terms of water treatment, I bet you there's hundreds. If you include expansions, I mean, very, very common. It's an everyday thing that people are adding capacity or, hey, our town has grown. We need a whole new plant on the other side of town. Not a big deal. The issue, of course, is can we pay for it with our water rates? You know, water is pretty inexpensive
if you got it. If you don't, it's not.
Right, but if you look at your water bill, a lot of people pay $25-$50, you know, don't think twice about it. But those days, I think, are going to come to an end when we have to deal with water shortages. I don't think this is true for the city of Chicago, because I think their Lake Michigan is always going to be a very stable supply. But there's a lot of places that are just flat running out of water, and they have to pipe it from a long way, introduce exotic treatment systems, do things that are going to just cost a ton of money. And I meet with my industry colleagues every so often, even though I'm retired, and I hear stories of people piping water from 150 miles away here in Texas just because they don't have anything else.
Well, in Chicago, I think the strain is not the lake. The strain is all these suburbs that have grown or coming online, and you're sharing. I think it's the facilities and the piping that's the problem.
Sure. No, not surprised at all, and everybody will just pay more, and I think they will willingly pay more for a safe water supply. No one will think twice about it because it's pretty standard stuff these days.
Well, one of Audrey's, well, friend of mine too, listener to the show, she has one of these loves the garden thing, right? Boy, in the summer her water bill is to the moon, and that area used to have wells, and I'm like, why can't you tap into the well for the stuff you're using on the flowers? And I think some people do.
You have to drill your own well, I guess. But
some of them had wells, and then they years ago, then they went to the city water. But I think the wells you can still get in. So, hey, what do you say we go to break and we'll come back and talk more about the. Have you ever worked on a water treatment facility, waste treatment, or the other side? What to do with it?
Times.
Well, let's talk a little bit about SP Futures up 14, NASDAQ Futures up 94. Again, individual stock, NVIDIA. I keep looking at this. The reason why I look at it and keep telling the listeners is because they have 25 billion shares outstanding. So when you're talking up $7 after like 10 yesterday, it's $175 billion in market cap in like one morning as we're sitting here talking about treatment facilities. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
Loading up Ace, Dice, and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 15. NASDAQ Futures up 96. Dow Futures up 62. Individual stocks in the Dow. We've got Caterpillar up $32. They had earnings yesterday. Caterpillar is, I don't know who the hell these guys are selling stuff to, but I mean, as a basic industry, I've never seen this kind of a move in kind of a while. I mean, we're talking these guys are up, where are we? We're talking in June of 25, the thing was 368, now it's 524. So it's up like $150 like this year. And, it, you know, I don't know how many Caterpillars they're selling, but it must be quite a few, or people thinking they're going to, one or the other. As we roll around the rest of the world, and our European markets have been quiet. Today, quiet again. DAX up 25, it's 0.1%. FTSE not so much, they're up 90, it's 0.9%, that's pretty good. The CAC around up 6, that's 0.1%. Mercedes is up 5%. Pace for best trading day since 2022. Maybe Bill went down and bought a Mercedes. We'll have to ask him when we come back here. Or maybe two Mercedeses, or maybe a Maybach. I can see Bill in a Maybach. The Bund, unchanged at 2.61. Where are we? Somehow we're not on our page here. I got the 10-year rate up at 3.99, so it's up a little bit, but still not back to 4%. Over in Asia, Nikkei is up 1,000 points. That's 2%. Now, they've been down the last couple of days, but they've made all that back. The Nikkei crosses 51,000 on Tokyo-Washington trade optimism. I don't. You declare a problem when there isn't a problem, and then you say you solved it, and we're up even more. I love that. I love the way it works, though, actually. Hang Seng down 87, 0.3%. Shanghai up 28, that's 0.7. So mixed on China, but the Nikkei is up pretty good. Oil down 9 cents, 60.06. Now it seems like 60 is the midpoint of the range instead of 63, so oil just can't get out of its own way. Very, very slow trader this year. The XLE, if you've been in that, and the Spider, you haven't done well at all. The Brent down 4 cents, 64.36. Gold, which has been down, is up $60 today, 4,042, back over 4,000. Silver up $1.10, 48, that's a 2.5% move in silver. That's a lot. Foreign exchange, we've got the dollar is a little bit stronger with the euro at 116.3 and the British pound at 132. That was 135 like 3 weeks ago or something. The Bitcoin down 776, 113, 138. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 8:36 here in Chicago.
Go Toronto, Blue Jays.
Oh, yeah. That's what I was going to say, that I'm probably not the first one here to tell you. But, yeah, last night the Blue Jays tied it up with the Dodgers. Now they're both at 2-2 and bringing it up to game 5. It's going to be tonight at 8 p.m. But, yeah, like I was saying, I'm sure everyone's probably heard that before. It's probably not going to be the first time they're hearing about that this morning. But in Chicago weather, it's currently 48 degrees. It's going to be a high of 56 today. Intervals of clouds and sunshine. It says right here a jacket may come in handy. As I can say from my own experience, and with the wind chill, it's feeling a lot more about, this says 39. I would say maybe even a little lower from my own experience. But over in Phoenix, they're currently at 66 degrees. They're going to have a high of 92. Warm and sunny day. Finally, for Chicago traffic, it is mostly business as usual. Traffic is heavy on all the inbound expressways. There was one, looks like it might have just, here we go, on the Kennedy. Let's see, yeah, an earlier disabled vehicle on the Kennedy heading west before Fullerton Avenue. It was reported at 7:36. It's updated just a little bit ago. Other than that earlier accident, no major things to report. So that's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
So, Bill, I was reminded back in our day as I went to pick Andrew up this morning, and he's got the long hair going and the shorts. Reminded me of the song as I changed, you know, came across A Child of God. I'm thinking it just kind of reverberated in my head. Say, Andrew, did you get the right weather report with those shorts? Well, obviously not. It's a little chillier than I thought. So there you go.
I will admit I dressed more. I had my outfit ready last night, and then I got up this morning and I was like, okay, yeah, it's not shorts weather, but it's kind of too late now.
I said, well, are you coming in to do the show, or am I dropping you off at the airport on your way to Miami or someplace? You know, just saying. So, what about water treatment stuff, and what about areas of the country, Bill, that it looks like Lake Mead's coming back some? We've had some better snow the last few years. Are there what happens if we've had the, if we have these kind of big time, I mean, people blame it on, you know, global warming. I don't know. When you and I were out at Lake Mead, all the guys did was say, we will never have, you know, it, we'll never use the what do you call those things? The spillways again. And then all of a sudden, a year later, they miscalculated. They had so much water, it was pouring over the spillways. And now here it is 30 years later, and it's down low. Are these just cyclical things that you don't, you no use worrying about? Or is it something you have to plan on? And so all of a sudden, the flow out of the Colorado is going to be less for 200 years? Or how do you assess something like that?
Well, these cycles, and we used to all chalk everything up to just, it's just the normal cycle, but it seems to us in the water community that the cycles have become more extreme. And that when the lakes go down, they go down more. When it rains harder. And I'll point to a very recent example in my area here. Before the July 4th weekend, the lakes, the major water supply lakes for the city of Austin and all the other little communities around here, were at 37% full. And I deal with the people at the city who worry about these things, because I'm on these committees. The mayor has appointed me as kind of an oversight person. So talk about this stuff all the time, and when it gets in the 30s, they get jumpy. And
and they should, right?
Of course, yeah. They're and we're all jumpy, you know, because the last thing we want to see is where we run out of water. And I spent years working as a volunteer on what they call the Water Forward Plan, which was developing a future water plan for the city of Austin so that they would have resiliency in the event the major supply lakes failed or were curtailed for whatever reason. And of course, part of the problem is the people that manage the lakes are selling water like crazy. They're looking, you know, they got home builders in there. And so it's like, so anyways, they were down going in the 4th of July weekend, and don't quote me on these numbers, but I think the lakes were 37% full. And the 4th of July weekend where we had that Camp Mystic tragedy, they filled them up over the weekend. It wow. just rained like holy hell in the right spot in the watershed. And at the end of the weekend, they were spilling waters out of the spillway. The lakes were overflowing.
Now, so, the spillway was in the river and downstream?
Yeah, they have dams every so often, and so all of a sudden they had to open gates and stuff because they would flood out houses. So they've got a whole management crew that watches the water levels, and if this one gets high, we open the gates and drop it down to the next level and drop it down. So, hooray, we're so smart, it rained. But it really hasn't rained since then. But again, the lakes are pretty full, so probably those lakes will be fine for a couple of years. And then in a couple of years, we'll
they got, well, they got like 8 or 9 inches, right, over the weekend?
Oh, they got more than that. And so, and it was in the absolute best spot in the watershed that really filled up the lakes that we needed filling. It was perfect. It was not perfect for the fact that in Kerrville, it washed out those campsites and killed all those kids and everything. But I mean, if you drive around the neighborhoods, we're still having green ribbons on the trees, you know, for the lost children and all of that, you know, kind of a tragedy. But normally, you know, these intervals between these shockingly low levels and these extremes are flatter, you know, they're not just like we go on, because in 2011 we had a real bad drought here. That's what got all this water planning going and got me on these committees. They said, hey, we got to do something. And we spent years plotting alternative water projects. One was called the Aquifer Storage and Recovery, which basically we will take water in times of plentiful water and put it underground in an aquifer. And also a second project called indirect potable reuse, where we'll take wastewater that is normally discharged into the Colorado River downstream of the city of Austin and clean that up and use that for various purposes, potentially drinking, but also could be less serious purposes.
Did like you say that a lot of golf courses now buy some of that for their watering stuff?
Every golf course should, and around here.
How do you get it? How do you tap into it?
The city has a network of piping called Purple Pipe. And why do we call it purple? Well, in the water business, we've got color coding, so you know if you're digging in the street and you see a pipe, what is it? If it's blue, it means it's drinking water. If it's brown, it's obviously wastewater. And purple is this intermediate product called reclaimed water, which is used for a whole lot of irrigation purposes. It could be used for your house, of course, but it just requires, you know, separate meter, and you have to be near enough to the line to make it worth it.
How clean or dirty is it?
It's pretty clean. It could be drinkable if you wanted to clean it up, but lots of times we just clean it up to a point that it's good enough for irrigation. And I always tell people that the golf course that I've played a few rounds of golf on has been irrigated with this product since the 70s. And it does have some nutrients in the water, so it kind of has a little benefit that way. And again, if you run out of that product, they have the ability to switch back to the drinking water as a backup.
It's interesting. So all this stuff, so you're saying that, I mean, some of the stuff that I don't, you know, I just heard of, you watch The Wizard of Oz, right? Well,
right.
I mean, Kansas used to be Tornado Alley. It seems like that whole tornado thing has moved about 200 miles south, hasn't it, in the last 25 years.
I agree with you. You know, you see tornadoes where there weren't tornadoes. You see earthquakes. I remember kind of a funny story. I was sitting somewhere, probably in the sports book at the Wynn Casino, and a gentleman plopped himself down next to me, kind of had been watching a few games, and he said, "You know how many earthquakes we've had at my house this year?" I said, "Where do you live?" He said, "Oklahoma." I said, "I have no clue." He said, "150.
Wow.
I said, "Really? I mean, are they like really bad?" "Well, shake the china out of the china cabinet."
Not just rattle it, but shake it out.
That's what he said. Wow. So, of course, this was all the fracking people. They've done this fracking now, and it's created earthquakes and many, many seismic events. So I think they're doing things to kind of slow the earthquakes down because it's become a problem. I mean, initially, they denied, no, those really aren't earthquakes. And then, well, they're earthquakes, but they're not our fault. And then, well, yeah, I guess we had zero earthquakes until you guys came along, and now we've got 150, your problem. And I think they've kind of acknowledged it's their problem, and they're trying to figure out what to do about it.
I was in a couple of minor ones. One was downtown when I first started down here. We were at 327, which is long now become the Board of Trade floor in the annex. All of a sudden, I'm sitting at my desk at like the seventh floor, and chair starts moving. I'm going, I don't think that's me. Just rocking back and forth a little bit, and I said, I think we're having an earthquake, and we were. I mean, it was a very... But I was actually the one that was down south. It was in Indiana. It wasn't New Madrid. But I was coming back from Tucson with this truck I bought. And I'm in this hotel in southern Illinois. And all of a sudden, the place starts shaking. I go, it's either an earthquake or a tornado is coming. I hope it's not a tornado. I could feel it. It was the bed was shaking enough to wake you up. And it wasn't like stuff falling down in the room or anything. But that was, you know, it was a 5 or a 4.5 or something. I mean, I've never been in a bigger one of you.
You know, when I lived in California in the late 70s, I was told that there were earthquakes when I was there, but I, for whatever reason, I didn't notice them. I mean, they weren't that severe, and just heard about them later. And I know they have had many, many severe earthquakes there, that if I'd have been there, I would have definitely felt them. But I don't think I've ever felt a real earthquake.
Well, how do you enhance or embrace both the climate change, it's happening this year, but I mean, you'll see a weather thing that was it's going to be 98 today, might break the old record of like 1953. Well, obviously it was 98 in 1953. I mean, at some point we did have the Dust Bowl, we had all kinds of things that, I mean, it's not like, is it the, I noticed this year that just in terms of weather, this summer was more miserable than I can remember, maybe because I'm getting older, but also Bill, we used to play ball all day long when it was 95 degrees, right, when we were younger, but this only getting down to 85, 86 at night, that's what did this like all summer. If you didn't have air conditioning, you were miserable. I mean, I don't care if it's 95 during the day, if it gets to 68 at night, but it wasn't. I mean, I'd leave in the morning and the guy'd go, oh, it's 75 at the lakefront, and I'm five blocks from the lake. I look at my thing in the car, and it says it's 87. I'm like, was the guy standing in the water? I mean, that kind of stuff seems... But you'll see, the amount of snow in the West. I mean, what was the name of the family that ate each other? Donners?
Right.
That particular year, the Sierra Nevadas got snowed in, and nobody could go anywhere, and that's when they started eating everybody. Well, then when they did the railroad, once they got the railroad done, I don't know what year it was after that, They didn't originally put snow fences in the mountains. All of a sudden, they had a year like the Donner year, and then none of the trains could move. So the next year, they made snow fences and all of it. I mean, there's always like these standout years every 25, 30, 40 years that seem to have always happened. But is it happening more consistently? I mean, the people today talking about the climate change can't be all wrong, but whenever you talk about, well, we just broke a record set in 1918. Well, hell, it had to be hot in 1918 too, didn't it?
Yeah, I think there's something to it. I don't know that I'm ready to jump over the cliff about it. I think we certainly need to pay attention. There seems to be a cycle or cycles that are unusual, and they're getting worse. And I just know it from the water side. Deeper troughs, peakier peaks, and it's kind of difficult to manage towards. And I know this as well, that the ocean is rising, and I don't know that from a theoretical calculation, but I want to say, in my perusal of the literature, the public works director of Miami Beach, he's got like a measuring stick. And he's reporting on his measuring stick that it's going up like a few inches a year. And they're very sensitive to it on Miami Beach because, of course, they're all real low. And, I mean, they are spending money on Miami Beach building walls and pumps to, not let the place be flooded.
Well, Bill, how do you contrast what you just said that I've heard on a bunch of areas, and that some of these areas in some of the zones of the world seem to be creeping up, and then all of a sudden you'll hear the other side. There's now a political argument, right? You'll see something on YouTube where somebody takes a shot of high tide or low tide at the Statue of Liberty and compares it to a picture from 1935, and it's the same spot. That you would think is it more dramatic in the central part of the world than it is in the north or the south? Or you would think that if the ocean's up 3 feet and you look at this picture from 1930, Statue of Liberty would be underwater, but it's not. I mean, I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just saying it seems to be, if you look at different places, the answer seems to be different. Or are people just doctoring the pictures?
I couldn't say if they're doctoring the pictures, but I can't say that there's perfect evidence either way. It just seems like... in my observation, there's something to this.
I think there is, too. I just wonder, I mean, if people say we're going up 3 inches a year, and you see a picture where it's 3 feet below you know, the base at the Statue of Liberty, that if it's 3 inches a year, it should be up to the thing's eyeball by now, and it's not. I mean, I guess what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, and we don't know when it started going up so many inches a year. It may have been 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it's going to take time, and again, it may go down a bit too, you know. So there's all these cyclical things that happen, but when you get into the world of flood control, it's pretty impressive. When I look at a place like the city of Houston, which is only 40 feet above sea level, they're spending a lot of money on flood control, because, you know, they get one of these hurricanes or get one of these events, and it just wrecks the town.
Oh yeah.
They just get flooded out, and they have this thing, you know, that they call storm surge, which, when the hurricane comes, it's dumping water and it's got a lot of wind behind it, and there's rain up in the watershed, so these two things collide into this big bloody mess. And you know, so they let so many people build in these flood zones that they shouldn't do. That's what they're kind of discovering with these Camp Mystic.
Yeah.
A lot of these dormitories that were built in the floodway. And
they were remodeled recently in the floodway.
Yeah, who would have ever allowed that? And you know, I'm like that, you know, but probably goes on. If you think about it, these camps are a big part of the city's, you know, tax revenue. So let's say when they want to add a building, get a building permit, and they've been doing this for years, hey, we just want to throw another dormitory, and it's just temporary, and it's just a bunch of kids for the summer. Yeah, we're in the floodplain, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I'll tell you what, the state got down there after this event, and I think they are going to tighten that program up big time.
Well, the thing that surprised me, we were talking about it on the show, it was such a horrible thing, that the, matter of fact, one of my best friends, his daughter's, I think it's the one who went to Providence. She went to Providence, and one of her best buddies had two daughters, and they were on one huge branch they found, and the older daughter made it, and the younger one didn't. I can't think of anything more horrible. Imagine the sister being there with your little sister, and she let go, and you couldn't save her. Oh, God. But anyway.
There's a lot of stories walking around this town of people, because it was those camps were considered kind of a pretty wealthy person's.
Oh, God,
thing.
Yeah.
They got the kids off for a few weeks, and mom and dad could go on a cruise and stuff, and no one expected, you know, they really thought those kids were well taken care of, and they generally were until you got the storm event of the century.
Well, I had the big plat, which you could make more sense of than me. It seemed like a lot of the camp, the cafeterias and all that stuff, they were in like, you know, 100-year flood spot, but the actual dorms for the young kids, they were like in a 10-year flood spot. It wasn't. But they always had, they were designed in such a way where if everybody got out in time, the places got wet and they just dried out and you were up. But they were actually in a spot, I mean, you shouldn't even camp, for God's sake, let alone build.
Right. Well, and the other thing they had, and I don't think this has ever been discussed very much, but they had a lot of RV campers that, you know, would drive in there for the weekend. And remember, this is 4th of July, so
yeah,
people driving in, and I don't know that they really knew who was there, where, because those little RVs were just blown away. And
well, I don't know if you, this is not a shot at Texicans, you being one of them now. I saw this video, Bill, and I don't know if I sent it to you. I couldn't believe it. There was some guy, I don't know how, it was raining, sort of, some dude gets out with his, you know, iPhone or whatever the hell it is, and he's doing a video of, he's on this bridge of this river, and all of a sudden you see this river start to get a little bit of wall of water come down, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, and all of a sudden you see all these branches, and then it's going over the top of the bridge. So all the idiot Texicans, not that they wouldn't be doing it here, are trying to race across the bridge while the water is only like 6 inches deep coming across the top of the bridge. I'm sitting there going, then there comes this house. comes down and whacks into the bridge, and these idiots are still coming across. Finally, the police show up, and they say, hey, you morons. I mean, if the water was another quarter inch higher, would have taken the car right off the top of the bridge into the water. And these guys are I can't imagine somebody dumb enough to do that. And then they told the guy who's standing on the bridge filming and say, hey, you got to get off the bridge too, you moron. I'm sitting there looking at this video going, what is with our school system, for God's sake?
But yeah, I guess, teach people the dangers of rushing waters, and it's amazing, you know, how people get caught in their car.
Oh yeah.
One of the people that died in that 4th of July event was the fire chief in one of the small towns, and you would think fire chief kind of ready for emergency problems and drove into some deep water, just swept him away, and I don't even think they ever found any of him. You know, he was just gone.
Well, my buddy from Florida, he had his brother, I think, or somebody, he had before the hurricane, a 2 year ago one, and he had these two cars. One was his like midlife crisis car, and another one was like a Jeep. He takes them like 5 miles inland or someplace into a garage. Well, after a hurricane, they go out there, the garage is gone, the cars have never been found. Either somebody got them or they're out in the swamp somewhere. When you get on these committees in this crazy world we're in, I mean, you obviously come across, because you are, you know, you're an engineer first. You're not going to play politics. I mean, you're worried about getting the thing done, and that's the way all the guys at Pullman were when it came to railroad cars and stuff. They could argue about other stuff when it came to what they're doing. When you get on these committees now, is there an edge to it where some people want to do this and that, have they become more political in the 20 years you've been on them, or is it still pretty much sober people?
Oh, it's pretty sober. It's a lot of people I would describe as specialized expertise people. And not all have the same expertise, but they know a lot of stuff. So I would say pretty serious. It's not a goof around thing. It's super dedicated kind of people that are, you know, looking at a problem and wanting to get it solved. And we donate, you know, hundreds of hours of our time getting the city to prepare this report and looking at all these problems and try to do it. And
so you have somebody walking in saying, oh man, it's all this global warming, and some other guy saying there is no global warming, all of a sudden fists are flying in the room, nothing like that?
We had the foremost expert on global warming that came to our meetings a couple of times and gave us her opinion, but it wasn't like we were all just buying that, you know, like, good to know, appreciate you telling us, you know, and yeah, we got to fit it in. But around here, some of the state agencies don't recognize global warming at all, and some do. You know, I think in Florida, like, the state agencies can't use the word global warming in any document.
Really?
And I don't know that that's quite right, but it's kind of, you know, that term is kind of migrated into a political dialogue a little bit.
Yeah. Well, so what was the, we're running out of time, what was the upshot of down to 37% in the lakes and all of a sudden fill up in 1 week? People think they're off the hook, or they figure if this is going to be like this, we're going to be doing this every 2 years, or
what? They think they're off the hook. Most lay people think they're off the hook. And then again, when it starts to get lower and lower, then the TV stations start to pick it up and show, uh-oh, look at this, here we go. And then the city people get a little powder in their step too, because once the lakes go back up, they kind of all set back. And we've got these projects that could help this. And when the lake levels get low, the city people start to burn rubber on these projects harder. And now, once the lakes fill up, you could just see them go into relaxation mode. I mean, they'd probably be offended if I said that to their face. But they do seem to drop back a little bit. But when it gets low, they get worked up. And, you know, we jab them pretty good. You know, like, where are we at? What are we doing?
Well, Texas has always been a feast or famine on water. It's a bad...
I totally agree with you. Yeah, this has been a... But the tricky part is now there's so many more people here, and trying to get at the water, and not just and now they're doing these data centers, which power hogs and water hogs, and the communities want the data centers. I think there's some number of jobs involved. You would know way more about that than me. And but they are tremendous water consumers.
You know, Bill, you know, we got a dash here, but there was one, Microsoft, this has to be I'm going to say 8 years ago, maybe six, when the cloud was the big deal, which, you know, Kevin has been on the show forever, has always talked about, hey, when it was already news, he was already saying, hey, I've been off, he used to work for Better World Books, he'd say, I've already been offloading my capacity in September and January when we need more computing. It's already competitive. I can go to all kinds of different people and get this is when, you know, everybody's going to make a fortune in the cloud. Now, obviously, Amazon and other people that you already touch anyway, if you're selling stuff through them, you know, have a leg up on you doing the cloud stuff through them. So it's not like there's no advantage there, or Microsoft, but there is. And Microsoft was putting these places around, and the first one I think they were going to do here was in Schaumburg or someplace. And they were going to be these massive centers where everybody could just off, you know, can buy computer capacity for them when they needed it. And the amount of, I think they were going to use, I'm just picking a number out of my head, they were going to be 40% of the power consumption of the city of Schaumburg or Park Ridge or wherever they were going. And then all of a sudden they canceled like all the rest of them around the country. And I don't even know if they ever finished that one. And now I see all this AI stuff doing the same thing. And I wonder, is it going to end up with the same result that 5 years from now, we don't need something like that. This is cheaper and other stuff. We don't need a whole nuclear plant power and a thing. I mean, I think we're going to have AI. I wonder, like Carl's always talking about, is it going to be, if you plan a city's water supply where these guys are going to need 50% of your water in 5 years, I don't know that it's going to end up that way. Do you?
I would be very cautious about making big commitments to those industries that can change on you on a dime and not do anything. I told you a story a few times about the city of Corpus Christi trying to build a desal plant to bring in a bunch of industry, and the cost of the thing just kept jumping and jumping and jumping, and finally the city council just pulled the plug and said, you know what, we may lose the industry, we don't care, this thing is just way too expensive. So I think it's going to get sorted out. I think they need to be a little more, these data centers need to figure their stuff out a little better. They just can't go into these communities like Schaumburg and say, we're going to take 40% of your power, or Corpus Christi, we're going to take half of your water, because I don't think that dog's going to hunt.
All right, bud, are you doing any golfing a little bit?
I'm doing a little bit, yeah. I'm getting out there a little bit, doing a few things, and keeping my, you know, keeping a good attitude. That's what I got.
All right, good for you, buddy. Thank you. It's always amazingly informative to me because, I preach on the show all the time. It's all kind of the same subject, right? I mean, it's people working together, doing stuff. How are we going to do this right? If we're going to have 12 years for nuclear plants, we better be careful what we destroy in the meantime because we might need it for 12 years. I mean, it all kind of makes sense if you just let it make sense, right? I mean,
That's totally right.
Take care, buddy. SP Futures up 18. NASDAQ Futures up 109. Good job, Andrew. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.